Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Episode 46 of the Drive Nation podcast. And this week, we're looking back at a handful of recent Drive Nation posts over on Instagram. We do this sometimes, mostly when a handful of our posts have sparked a bit of debate, a bit of discussion. And this podcast is just a good opportunity for us to respond to some of that conversation. Andrew, we're filming this one again over Zoom. So hello, people watching on YouTube. Some people commented, responded to us, and they were kind enough to pretend that they enjoyed being able to see our faces while we chat rubbish.
Hard to imagine.
Well, I think perhaps people actually enjoyed peering inside our houses. I mean, they're not seeing much inside my house.
No, you've gone very stealth, haven't you?
If anybody looks at mine, they'll find our
endless car books on my wall. There's not very anything particularly interesting there either.
Well, no, but at least people can see that you're not pretending to be obsessed with cars.
People do this, though, don't they? There's all sorts of research that's come out now about exactly the things you need to have in the background of your Zoom call to establish your maximum credibility with whoever it is that you're talking to. So this is, in fact, carefully curated. These aren't actually books at all. They're just sort of big sheets of stuff that I put up there which make to look like books.
It's just wallpaper. Well, talking of credibility, I think that's a photograph over your... Is that your... I can't tell because it's flipped. Is that your left shoulder?
That's my left shoulder.
Is that a Lister Costing coupe at Goodwood?
It is. That one there. Yes, that's me racing the one and only, literally, Lister Costing coupe. This is the car that actually won the TT at Goodwood last year with a boat called Andre Lotterer driving it. Then it was me sharing it with Richard Atwood in 2011. I'm going to stop making excuses now. But we had a sick engine. And we had terrible conditions, and you can set it up for the wet or the dry, it's fine, but it hated going from one to the other. We came, I don't know, so you could probably see from there, I can't remember where we came, I think we came sort of 10th or 11th, and it was great fun. So there you go.
Well,
that was me sharing a list with Richard Atwood at Goodwood.
That's very cool. Yeah, talk of credibility. Right, let's get stuck in. So the first one I want to talk about, and we're not going to do loads on this, but last week you reviewed the Porsche Taycan. And
yeah.
I mean just Taycan, the base model, which is just called Taycan. There's nothing, suffixes there. I want to talk about this one because there were a few responses in the comments section underneath. And I think one in particular said, if this car is so bad, why is it still an 8 out of 10?
Well, because it's not so bad. I mean, it's a fairly simple answer, isn't it? I mean, if Porsche had launched that car, and we hadn't already had the 4S, and we didn't know any of the other stuff about it. It would still get an 8 out of 10, but it would get an extremely positive review because it's a really good car. You know, other than the 4S, there's not an electric car out there that I would rather have. But you have to see these cars in context, don't you? You have to see them in the perspective of, you know, what else has become available, has already been available. And to me, yeah, the 4S, which is absolutely the best electric car, is just a better proposition for reasons I went into in the post. The standard Taycan, and the point that I kind of made is that we, the Porsche purists, we always bang on, don't we, about, you know, less is more, and, you know, it's always the entry-level car, particularly with things like 911s. And you'd think that the standard Taycan, you know, the rear engine, rear wheel drive, the kind of, you know, Porsche 911 of Taycans, would therefore, by that basis, be the one to have. But it's just, it just hasn't quite got enough get up and go. You know, aren't, you know, so, you know, electric cars, you know, one thing they do well is they do the business of going fast pretty well. And I'm not that interested in electric cars will get to 60 in 2.1 seconds. But nevertheless, at the other end of that, you know, there has to be a level of convincing performance. And it's just not quite there. And it's got, I think it's about, I don't think it's quite as quick to 60, even if you've got the big battery, as the Mustang Mach-E electric SUV. Okay? And yeah, whereas a 4S, you put your foot down in that and the thing really, really goes. And this one doesn't. And if there was an enormous benefit in terms of the way that the car handled, because it was so much lighter, that would be one thing. Or if it had a much bigger boot because it doesn't have an electric motor in the front, that would be another. But it doesn't. I mean, it's 90 kilos lighter, but in the context of a 2.1 ton car, that's not that much. It's no more practical. I mean, really, it's the car that you have if you really want an electric Porsche. And money is important to you. And I think it's like 13 grand cheaper than a 4S. And I think, you know, on those grounds, it's absolutely, there's a very, very strong case for it. You know, if you're going to spend 70 grand on an electric car, I wouldn't suggest for a moment you do anything else. The only point I sought to make is that a 4S is a better shot if you can afford it. That's it. Not the Turbo or the Turbo S, because as I've said before, I think that they go too far. They provide a level of performance which is not really usable for a huge additional cost. But yeah, I think of all the Taycans, the 4S is the absolute runaway best of them all.
Next door's washing machine is on a spin cycle. So forgive me if you can hear that clattering away in the background. It sounds like late 1990s, early noughties Golf diesel engine doing 4,000 RPM while stationary. Hopefully you won't be able to hear that too loudly in the background. Yeah, the thing about this base Taycan still being an 8 out of 10 is that we review cars in context, don't we? We come at them from a perspective. And the context with this base Taycan is that it follows the earlier models. One in particular is probably, as you describe it, the best electric car you can buy at the moment. And so what we're doing is comparing it in that context. And so you can find it ever so slightly underwhelming, perhaps, and it still be an exceptionally good car.
Yeah, you've got to look at it in terms of the alternatives that are out there. You know, both the Porsche alternatives and the non-Porsche alternatives. And there's only, of them all, one other electric car on sale which I'd rather drive, which is the 4S.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make it a bad car, does it?
No, I had something similar with the GR Yaris. There's already a bit of a community around that car and people who feel quite strongly about it. And I've said in the past that it's brilliant, but actually there are other, even hot hatches, that I would prefer to drive on the road.
That Fiesta you drove, for one.
That's right, yeah. Which is...
Yeah.
Honestly, that car is more fun for me than some Lamborghinis on the road. You know, I just... It's a little gem, that car. It's a really special little thing. I just adore it. And you know, it's interesting. You can say that publicly, that the I find the Fiesta more fun than the Yaris, and people will read that as though I've got a real downer on the Yaris. And I think there's a bit of a narrative now that says I think it's overhyped and underwhelming. But actually, that's not true at all. I think it's a brilliant thing.
It's a great car.
But sometimes we're out there looking for the cars that will be icons, that will change the game, and almost by definition, most of them fall flat. And so we're just describing them in those terms, aren't we? We're not saying that they're in any way bad cars.
No, not at all. So are you going to talk to us about the Litchfield Yaris, which I'm itching to have a go in?
That's in my list. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's do it. So, yeah, what have they done with it? These are early days, actually. there's much more to come. They've got two cars, which is why they've been able to do some engine tuning and some chassis tuning already.
Just before you go into this, do you think you ought to just explain to people who Lichfield are and what they do, just in case they're...
What people don't know about my connection to Ian Lichfield, and actually it's entirely coincidental, is that we went to the same school, years apart though, the Castle School in Thornbury. He certainly went to the sixth form. I'm not sure if he went to the secondary school. But he set up his tuning company. Actually, I mentioned that because Lichfield Imports, as it was known, it started as a sixth form project. I think he did some sort of case study on importing cars, MX-5s, I believe, from Japan. And the case study was so good that his tutor told him that he should go and do it. And so he did. He just started importing cars. But anyway, over the years, he's built up this very, very highly regarded tuning company. Made its name originally with Subaru Imprezas, but then more recently and more emphatically with Nissan GT-Rs. Excuse me. And particularly as everything switched to turbocharging, that just opened this whole new world of opportunity for tuning companies, because they can actually just get into the ECUs and turn the boost up, and then, you know, of course, do lots besides. But he now has this very, very highly regarded tuning company that, if you go to his place, you see just rows and rows of Nissan GT-Rs. But they'll do everything now. They'll do McLarens, they do BMWs, they do... Mercedes AMGs, the whole lot. And so he's bought himself two of these GI Yaris's because, A, he just loves cars, and there's such a hype around this car, and it's so exciting for all the right reasons. He just felt like he had to have a go. But also because a lot of his clients, who have collections of very high-end stuff, they all just wanted a GI Yaris because it's such a brilliant little concept. So he's got a couple of them, and he's been fiddling about with them. He's got two cars, one's for engine development, one's for chassis development. And so the engine car, as I said, these are early days. It's just a plug-and-play ECU tuning box, which costs £600, and you use an app on your smartphone to switch between maps. And so that lifts power to about 300 horsepower.
And you could presumably turn up there in your car and drive it away again, however long, an hour later, with them having done it.
Exactly. Yeah, turn up with 260 horsepower, leave with 300. And it definitely feels quicker, just pulls harder through the mid-range, up to the top end. I mean, that little engine, that little turbo three-pot is a ripper anyway, but it just gives it a bit more urgency. It's not night and day, though. And I think that night and day power upgrade will come once they've cracked the ECU, once they've done exhaust and intake systems, once they've done much more detailed, in-depth engine tuning. Having said that, it's a tiny car, it's quite light. 300 horsepower
Does it need it? Would you choose to go and throw all your money at that, or would you choose to throw it at, you know, we said this about the GRS before, haven't we, that it's amazingly fast, and it's a pretty extraordinary thing actually to drive on both the rail or track, but it could be even more fun than it is if it was just a little bit more flamboyant. And if I was going to be spending money on it, because, you know, you wrote about the chassis car and the suspension that it's got and just how adjustable that suspension is, so presumably you could just really, you know, stiffen it up at the back and just get it skidding around all over the place if you wanted to.
I suspect you could. So the chassis upgrade is a set of Nitron coilovers, and they're two-way adjustable, so for bump and rebound, through 25 damper clicks, so there's quite a lot of adjustability in them. And you're right, if that's what you want to achieve, I suspect you could soften off the front axle, stiffen up the rear axle, put all that roll resistance into the back, and therefore make the car more inherently oversteer, you know, shift the balance towards oversteer. I'd love to have a go at that. I didn't when I was there, and the coilovers were set up somewhere down the middle. And so there was still that kind of tension in the ride quality that you expect from that sort of car. But just allowing each wheel and each tyre just to breathe a little bit over the bumps. But also that the body control, particularly when you land into a compression, it does what for me the best damped cars do, and you'll land into the compression quite hard at speed, and it'll be one damper stroke, and then you're back to middle, you know, back to the center point.
Yeah.
As though it always feels like
oscillation.
No oscillation, no scraping, no running out of travel, none of that. Yeah. No bouncing up again, just away you go. The way, if you watch rally cars on tarmac, World Rally Championship cars on tarmac, sometimes you see them going through these dips and compressions. You just think, oh my God, how is that thing so tautly controlled without skipping about all over the place? And that's because the dampers are unbelievably good on those things and perfectly tuned and set up. And so, yeah, these Nitron dampers on the Litchfield car are very good. But I actually think that half the fun would be fiddling about with those damper clicks and learning what the differences are and getting the car set up exactly the way you like it for a particular road or for going out on circuit or whatever. Just, I think it adds another dimension to that ownership, which would be just great fun.
Mega. Before we go on to the next point, I just have to go and do something off camera. I'm actually going to blow my nose, which I don't think that people really need to see. So if you just bear with me one second, I keep talking. Oh.
Such professionals.
And he's back in the room.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
Okay. Actually, do you know what? I just want to mention Nitron again, because Ian's got an A110, an Alpine A110, and he's got his car
It's another podcast with an A110 just sneaking in through the back door, isn't it?
I know, you probably thought we were going to mention go a whole hour without talking about
I did naively entertain the possibility, but clearly not. Sorry, you were talking about your A110.
Not my A110, no, Litchfield's A110, because it's on a set of these Nitron coilovers.
Okay.
And it's his car, I think it probably looks a bit too low to the ground for my taste, but his is set up on the deck, so it looks like it's really squat to the ground. But these dampers are so beautifully set up that the car rides even better than the best standard A110s I've driven.
So how long is it going to be before your A110's on them too?
Well, I think they're a couple of grand, maybe even $3,000 for a set of this suspension. So
be a good time to mention our Patreon account then?
Patreon.com/DriveNation. If you want my A110 to get a nice fancy set of Nitron dampers. Okay, let's leave that one there. All right, I also want to talk about the Toyota GT86, because last week was a big week for that car.
Yes.
The UK's last GT86 was sold. So bravo to whoever bought that car. You've got the last one in the UK. So the car was on sale for 9 years. It arrived here in 2012. And according to Toyota UK's figures, 7,500 were sold. What do you think when you hear that number?
Depends, doesn't it? Depends what, I mean, it's not a lot.
No.
But it's not a train wreck either, but it's not very many. I mean, compared to, you know, Audi TTs.
Yeah.
Or any car like that, or I suspect even compared to more expensive stuff like, you know, Porsche Caymans. It's probably not a big number. But at the same time, I think the very fact that you and I are having this conversation is evidence of the success of that car. The very fact that we're talking about Toyota and, you know, what fun cars they've been making. This is this is the purpose that goes beyond the showroom with these cars. They are all, I mean, even if they are lost leaders, they are all there to, you know, brighten up the brand, aren't they? And to create associations and to make people feel better about the business of owning a Toyota. And I think in those terms, as I'm sure the GR Yaris is already doing, I think it's done the job it set out to do. And in the meantime, those of us who've been lucky enough to drive them have had a huge amount of fun. You were a bit down on it. I mean, I went back on it because I knew we were doing this podcast. I went back and read what you wrote. I'm not talking about mismatched control weights and, you know, what else did you say? Your notchy gear change and the coarseness of the engine and everything else. And I just wonder what kind of mood you're in when you wrote that stuff. Because, I mean, to me, not a perfect car at all. But there's a big picture there, which is that if you had one, every time you drove it, you would oversteer.
Yeah, you've said this before. You've never completed a journey in one without doing a skid.
Well, no, because, you know, you can, and why wouldn't you? And it's And I love it. I forgive Ulrika an awful lot for the ability to do that.
In the next slide, I think I did say it now seems churlish to nitpick like
yes.
that. Because
well, it did.
Basically,
you're actually correct.
The car's heart, I said this in the piece, the car's heart was in the right place. If you love driving, it just set out to be brilliant to drive. You know, it's light, actually, for just about a four-seater coupe. It's small. It's a manual box, normally aspirated engine. And it's just set up to be fun to drive. That's the whole point of it.
Yeah, and Prius tyres. They really weren't, you know, tyres which are quite like Prius tyres or the same size as Prius. They were Prius tyres. So, that, I mean, were you there at Autocar that day when we had one for handling day? Or were you not at Autocar then? Okay, so where did we do it? I think we did it at Rockingham, I think, or Bedford. Bedford, maybe. Anyway, I can't remember where we were, but what I can remember is A, it won, beating a huge amount of the Porsches and the Ferraris and the Lambos and all the stuff that usually turn up. And despite the fact that this car spent an entire day going sideways, while other cars, which were much less flamboyant, you know, eight sets of tyres and, you know, I kept on having to be reshod. By the end of it, you looked at the GT86's tyres and you could barely see they worn. They were so hard, which just meant you could just keep on enjoying it and skidding it around. And, yeah, it was a joyous car. I mean, not perfect by any means. You know, certainly a better car to drive than to live with. And a, you know, particular certain sort of person's car. But, you know, if you were that person, wow.
Yeah, I have driven one at Bedford and I just had a real blast. I think I enjoyed driving it there more than anywhere else. And it was, just such fun to hoon about in. And if you enjoy driving on circuit, I just think that's exactly the kind of driving that you'll enjoy. You're not going that fast, really, but you'll be having a great time.
Did you ever drive the Subaru?
Good question. I don't think I did. Was there any discernible difference between?
Definitely.
Was there?
Definitely.
Oh.
Yeah, the Subaru was... Actually, if I owned one, I'd actually probably get the Subaru, because although I loved the ridiculous... flamboyance of the GT86, the Subaru was just better. It was just set up slightly differently. And it was just... I mean, it was still slide and slide, do whatever you wanted to do, but it wasn't kind of, its default setting wasn't sideways. You kind of had to prod it a bit, and then it would still do it, and then it was fine. And it just felt a little bit more grown up, I suppose. And I think that were you to live with both cars for a year, I think at the end, I think you'd probably prefer the Subaru just because it would still do all that stuff, but, you know, if you didn't actually want to go to work looking out the side window, then you didn't have to. I don't prefer it night and day. It was interesting that Subaru went a slightly different way with it, and just to see almost the sort of philosophical approach to setting the cars up that the two companies took. I think for one lap, definitely the Toyota, but for a lifetime, the Subaru.
Interesting. Going back to the GT86, then I think it not only reminded the world in 2012 that Toyota could build fun cars, I think it also reminded Toyota that it could build fun cars. Because the Supra came a few years after. We've now got the GR Yaris. It's been involved in at Le Mans and the World Endurance Championship for many years now.
Yeah.
And I saw someone on Twitter say, is it possible that Toyota is now the world's most exciting car brand? And you can have a discussion about that, can't you? From an enthusiast point of view, they're doing some great stuff now.
I mean, it is amazing given where they've come from. Toyota have, I'm old enough to remember, the original MR2. So they have done this from time to time, and they've obviously, the Supra's been around for, in various guises, on and off, for years. So Toyota have always known how to do these sorts of cars, but I don't think there's ever been quite so concerted an effort to really, really establish its credentials than we're seeing at the moment. And it's great. And it's because Toyota-san, the main man at Toyota, is a complete and utter rampant raging petrol head. And I think that he really gets these sorts of cars and the benefits they can provide for his company.
Yeah, good. And we're confident that the GT86 will be replaced. The BRZ yeah. has been replaced, but it's not coming to Europe, the new car. Reportedly, the new GT86 will be the GR86, which makes sense, that they have this new GR naming thing for their fast cars. Some reports say it'll be turbocharged, but the BRZ isn't. It's got a 2.4-litre normally aspirated engine. We don't know. But give us three priority jobs for this new car to improve over the old one.
More torque. So what it mustn't do is weigh considerably more. That's job one. I think we have to accept these days that these sorts of cars, particularly if they're going to gain things like turbochargers, which are heavy and have more power, which requires more cooling, and weight is an issue. So you really don't want the weight to go up very much, if at all. That's job one. Job two is to provide the car with some torque, which the turbos will do. I think that the GT86 had a problem. It was, it's quite a small engine producing quite a lot of power. And the only way you can do that from normally aspirated engines is to make them rev. And you did have to really, really work at a GT86. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but I think that, if you had the choice of not having to do that, that would be good. And I think, the third thing, just in practical terms, is just to give it a slightly more civilised interior, just make it just slightly more user-friendly, because I think that means it'll just be more popular and more people will get to enjoy it, so long as it still has that, that wonderful approach to the open road.
Yeah, I mean, it's just great that Toyota are sticking with it. We were in a discussion during the Supra launch, weren't we, a couple of years ago with some engineers from Toyota who explained to us that by the skin of its teeth, the GT86 is considered a commercial success within Toyota HQ. It was a finely judged thing. And so bravo to them for going, okay, well, it didn't make us any money, but it does a huge amount for Toyota's credibility within a certain market.
What do you, seeing as we're just talking Toyota and you're talking about the Supra launch, what did you think of, or what do you think of the Supra? I haven't driven the new four-cylinder one. Which I'm looking forward to, but I guess given that you own one of its rivals, whether you thought that car was absolutely on the money or something of a pulled punch.
I came away from that first launch in Spain thinking pulled punch, thinking I expected a bit more. It just seemed quite a middle of the road sports car and very GT like actually. Which is perhaps what they wanted from it, I don't know, but I've never longed to drive one again. And I've driven them since. I've driven the 2-litre car as well, and I'm just not quite sure why you would pick it over some of the exceptionally capable rival cars that it's up against. That 50 grand sports car category nowadays, I mean, wow, there's so much stuff in there. And I don't know what they need to do for me. Maybe I'm waiting for a lighter, more focused one. A GR, I don't know. Well, it is a GR, isn't it?
But it's kind of like a GR, kind of proper. What surprised me about it was, we were talking to those engineers, weren't we? And we were quizzing them quite closely about just how Toyota it is and just how kind of BMW Z4 it is. And they said, no, absolutely. Absolutely, we got the same underpinnings, but in terms of the way the cars were developed, we literally didn't talk to them. We had no conversations. There were no shared testing programs. We never went to any of the same places. We never did the same things. The first time we found out what a Z4 was like was when it had been done. They never drove our car. We never drove their cars. And yet you go and drive it and you think, it's really quite like a Z4, isn't it? I was disappointed as well, which doesn't mean I think it was bad. But if you put it in a triple test with a Cayman and an A110, it would come third. A lot of that speaks volumes for just how capable are the cars in that category now. But at the same time, you have this opportunity to really make a statement. And I guess maybe it's because they've got to keep, they have to bear in mind, you know, the cars to sell all over the world to all sorts of people. And maybe they took the view that they've got the GT86, which is playing the really fun card, and so what they want is a car which is actually far more user-friendly, and, you know, it may appeal less to idiots like you and me, but actually out there to the mainstream. The fact that it is quiet and comfortable and everything else is far more important than, you know, whatever you or I might prioritise ahead of that. I think they should still do a lightweight, more powerful, stiffer, proper driving machine. And I think probably they've got the platform for it. I don't see why you can't do that. So I hope they do.
Yeah, really uncork it, really go for it. So I have driven the 2-litre car, the 4-cylinder one, 100 kilograms lighter. And you feel that, you do sense that. It doesn't feel underpowered. Still got 258 horsepower, I think.
100 kilograms, that's a lot, isn't it?
It is a lot, yeah. It is a lot. You do feel it, but it doesn't fundamentally change the character of the car. Still feels quite GT-ish, still feels big around you. I always find it difficult to feel like I'm right on top of that car and wringing everything out of it. I don't feel that way in that little French sports car. I don't feel that way in a Cayman or even an M2 Comp. You know, I feel like I can get right on top of them and wring them out. But the Supra always just keeps me at arm's length a little bit, and I've never fallen for it because of that.
No, fair comment.
Do you think, as of last week, you've driven a brand new Lotus Elise variant for the last time? Unless they bring the name back.
Absolutely. Yes. They've called it the final edition, so they'd have to final edition, or the we were only kidding edition.
Yeah,
I do. And, you know, a really good way to go out. You know, a cracking little car. So the final edition of the Elise, which will be in production from now until the autumn. They say that production will be limited, but I love it when car manufacturers do this. McLaren did this with a 600LT. They said production will be limited, and you say, well, to how many units? And they won't tell you. And what they mean is it's limited to the number that we can build and the number that we can that we can sell. And in the Elise's case, it is capped simply by the fact that they need the factory back for converting to the Type 131, whatever that's going to be, by the autumn. So it will, the Elise will die in the autumn, as will the Exige, as will the Evora, as we know. And, you know, 25 years on, I think it's still an absolutely cracking sports car. I mean, it's not cheap anymore. You know, the final edition is £45,000. So we've already talked about some of the sorts of cars that's up against. I mean, that's kind of nudging on the door of Boxster and everything else. But actually, as a thing just to get in and hoon around in, they're still brilliant because they still weigh... Okay, they're not as light as they used to be, but they've got a lot more power than they used to have. And it's still less than a ton of car. It's still really, really low. It still feels really structurally, you know, for a car without a roof, it still feels structurally really stiff. And it's got that thing you were talking about, but even more so. You just feel so on top of it. You just feel so much part of the machine. And you just feel that you can place it anywhere, do anything with it, and... everything that you really want a proper driving machine to be. I'll miss it because, you know, I was around, the first time I ever went in an Elise was, it might even have been 1995. If it wasn't 95, it was certainly very early 96. And I had a sort of slightly, one of those sort of off the record meet and lay by outside of test track meetings with Matt Becker, who now is head of, you know, chassis development and engineering in Aston Martin. But he was a very young, fresh-faced lad there, and his dad, Roger Becker, was the Lotus chassis handling guru. And Matt and I went off in this car. I wasn't allowed to drive it. It was one of those ghastly passenger seat assessments that you have to do, which I hate. But even I... back then, even from the passenger seat, could just tell, just because you can tell how well a car is damped, you can get a feel for its poise and that sort of, and I can just remember thinking, this is what a Lotus should be. You know, it is small, it is light, it is clever, it is simple, it is absolutely a car of which Colin Chapman would have been very, very proud. And I think the proof of the pudding, not that we knew it at the time, was that 25 years later, I mean, it survived for 25 years, which is over a third of the entire time that Lotus itself has existed. And, you know, and it kept the company alive in that time. I mean, you know, obviously there was the Exige, which came along, which is, you know, essentially the same car, but with a roof. And I don't imagine Lotus ever made much money out of the Evora. And yet, you know, it sold so well and it lasted so long that 2018 was the best sales year Lotus had ever had. And I'm sure, I don't know how many cars they sold, but I would bet you plenty that the vast majority of them were releases. And even then, that was like 22 years after the car came out. So, you know, one of, and I've said this before, it's not just a great Lotus. It is one of the world's greatest sports cars of any period and of any kind. And, you know, I hope that one day they'll do another. I think that there is a considerable incentive not to do another. Yeah, for several reasons. You know, it's quite low volume, and because you can't charge the world for it, it's quite low margin. You know, Lotus, I think, has said that its future is going to be increasingly, or maybe even exclusively, electrified. So, you know, I don't know how you make an electric Elise. But they also, you know, would say things like, well, of course, by the time we have to do that, everything else will be electric too. So you won't be comparing it to cars which don't exist anymore. You'll be comparing it to other electric cars. And the job is not to do as well then as the Elise does now. The job is to do better then than any of its rivals do at the same time. And that's a perspective we don't have at the moment. But yeah, I mean, I'm always interested to see what those guys do. And it's great that they've got some money behind them now, because, you know, then hopefully we will really be able to see what they're capable of. But in the meantime, you know, bye-bye, Elise. You know, thanks for all the fun. It's been a blast.
Yeah, and we know that there will be an electric sports car coming from Lotus soon, because they're partnering with that French company, and they're building a shared architecture, electric architecture, aren't they? And the Alpine will be a replacement for the current A110. We think 2025 or 26, so a few years to go. But that raises such an interesting question. I mean, if those guys, you think the combined talents and capabilities that Lotus and Alpine have in making fun, engaging sports cars, if between them they're not able to make an all-electric sports car somehow great to drive, then there must be something inherently wrong with that kind of powertrain. Because, well, just look at the credits that they have to their name. It's, what do you reckon? So we can talk about it in context of the A110, because the current car is 1,100 kilos with a piston engine and a dual-clutch box. I reckon that with a useful range of maybe up to 200 miles, the electric replacement for that car will be maybe 1,350 kilograms, perhaps a bit more. That's still not, it's still pretty light, isn't it?
And you will be, they will be able to, they'll have much more freedom to put the weight where they want to. You know, I presume it'll have the usual sort of skateboard layout, so the batteries are all slung along the floor of the car, so very, very low. You know, they will be able to do really, really clever things with things like torque vectoring. You know, we've seen this happen in the Taycan already, haven't we? Just how it disguises its weight. And how agile you can make a car like that feel. So, you know, if it is still really... And also, the other thing is that, you know, a range of 200 miles for a car like that will be acceptable in 5 or 6 years' time, because the... Well, let's pray, the recharging infrastructure will be, you know, fit for purpose, and because it won't have a very big battery, and because you'll be able to charge it at, I don't know, a couple of hundred kilowatts, you know, you'll probably only be stock still for 10 minutes, which is probably the same period of time you'd have done anyway. If you so from all those points of view, then I think it's, you know, I think they're certainly quite encouraging. But it's all the sort of, you know, it's the sound and the feel, and it's everything else. And, you know, 1,350 kilos, you know, compared to a Taycan, no, it's not very heavy. But for, I mean, actually, it's, you know, it's not that much heavier, I don't think, than an Exige or an Evora is at the moment. And we don't necessarily criticise those for being too low. So maybe there is something to play for. But, you know, I remain, I've said this before, electric sceptic. Where it comes to those sorts of cars, where it comes to cars who, unlike the Taycan, which is clearly a tool for doing a job, and it's an everyday, you know, it's a commuter car, it's a long distance car. When the job becomes to provide driving pleasure, which it just must be for any Lotus sports car, that's a very different thing. And, you know, it is going to be difficult for people to kind of forget the past and forget the time where Lotus made cars with normally aspirated or certainly internally combustion powered engines, and not make the comparison between the two. And if the electric cars haven't found a way of replacing all those things we know that they're going to lose, then it's going to be very hard to conclude anything other than, you know, things ain't what they used to be. And then you'll get people like me just boring for Britain on the subject. So let's hope for that reason alone they find a way around it.
Yeah, we're both electric skeptic when it comes to sports cars in particular, aren't we? But I mean, we have to be that way because no one has proven us wrong yet.
Not yet.
Have they? No one's come along with a really valid, great to drive electric sports car. We know they're coming.
Well, there haven't been any, has there? I mean, there's the Tesla Roadster from way back, and no one else has had a go at it yet.
No. So, yeah, I mean, we'll have to be sceptical until we're proven one way or the other. Okay, right. I want to talk quickly about TVR stories because you wrote a piece sharing I suspect it's not your favourite TVR story, but the TVR story that leaps to mind when you're asked to think of one. And actually, quite a frightening thing. You narrowly avoided being in a Cerbera at the Nürburgring?
It was a black 4.5-litre Cerbera. And it was a really... I mean, the bloke who drove it was okay. But it was a big accident. It was a really big accident going down the foxhole. I mean, just if you haven't read the post, I mean, very briefly, I used to be hired by a track day company to go and show their newbies around the Nürburgring, not out of the kindness of their heart at all, but because on previous occasions when that hadn't done, they all went bouncing off the scenery, and every time that happens you have to shut the track, which meant all their other punters got really, really annoyed because they could see their track time, which they paid a lot of money for, just sort of going up in smoke while, you know, lorries pulled bent cars out of the scenery. And it was actually quite successful. I mean, their crash rate fell through the floor once people who hadn't before kind of knew where the danger points were, which is pretty much all of it. But it was just a kind of cautionary tale about never being driven by people you don't know, particularly not in quite spiky cars around the Nürburgring, because I'd shown this bloke round and I always did all the driving. And he'd actually driven really, really well, really, really well for a couple of days. And it was that usual thing, wasn't it? It was Sunday afternoon, you know, everybody's getting ready to go home. And you think, well, I'm just going to do one more lap or two more laps or whatever. And you don't realise just how tired you are. And he came over to me and said, look, I've just, you know, thanks so much for your help. I've learnt so much. Just, you know, jump in the car. I'll show you around and, you know, you can see how much progress I've made. And I just thought, well, it's a lovely invitation, but I'll think I'll go and, dry my hair or something, and so I didn't get in the car and he rolled it into a ball and that was that. So cautionary tale, just don't ever do it. I mean, however much fun, and actually I can tell far more horrific tales of really, really bad stuff that's happened when people have got into cars with people they don't know and it's gone wrong. Just don't do it.
And the reason that you shared this story is because a couple of weeks ago TVR in its current form, guys came out and said, no, we are going to build this new Griffith. It is happening. Our factory is going to go up soon. There's an enormous amount of scepticism about that whole thing. But I don't know, maybe they will start building these cars at some point. But the point being was that you asked for people's TVR stories because if you're a British car enthusiast, perhaps of a certain age, you're bound to have one, aren't you? And we got some brilliant responses. That post, I think we had 100 comments in reply, and I've dug out a few on my phone here. And I think between them, they sort of nicely sum up what it is about TVR, why their cars can be so beguiling and so frustrating, and why so many people have loved owning them, but now say they just never go back. There's one here from Muck Monkey, who had a racing green Griffith 500, a year old when he bought it with 1,500 miles on the clock. Monstrous car, he says, which made the best noise but had the worst handling ever. Driving along one day on a country lane, the car just stopped, wouldn't start again. As I got out and shut the door, the wing mirror fell off. Turns out it had blown the ECU. And he says, that sums up owning a TVR for me. Got rid and went to Porsche, never looked back. He says, actually, that's a lie. I went to see a Cigaris at the TVR dealer. When I tried to sit in it, the salesman said, and this is no lie, can you get in the passenger side as the driver's door won't open? That's great, isn't it?
There's a mate of ours called Ben Samuelson who will be watching this because he's a huge fan and supporter of Drive Nation. I think I've spoken to him about it all. He used to be the PR man for TVR. He used to be the bloke who used to borrow the cars from, and every time they went wrong, which of course it never happened, he would be the bloke who'd have to try to convince you that actually TVRs were as reliable as Porsches, and this was just like a sort of freak one-off, and you'll probably have steam coming out of his ears even listening to us saying this now. So have you got any more stories?
Yeah, there's another one here from Chris Walker 100, who he had a Cerbera and he loved it. Sounds like he had a great time in it. No big mechanical issues, thankfully. Although I once had to get sellotaped inside for a drive to the dealer because the driver's door catch fell off and it wouldn't stay closed.
Sellotaped in your TVR. Oh,
that's brilliant,
superb.
Isn't it?
That's superb.
He then moved into a Corvette C5, another plastic fantastic, which felt like it would run forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. If you haven't seen it already, go and find that post. It's called... what do we call it? Let's have your TVR stories, please. Look for a yellow Cerbera. And just go and read some of the comments. There's one from our mate Dickie Meaden, who said he blew a Rover engined one up while chasing John Barker and Mark Walton across the North York Moors on a performance car test between a TVR and an M3. Proper 80s F1 spec smokescreen job. Imagine the embarrassment when all the people I'd overtaken during the pursuit drove by me while I was sat by the side of the road. Yeah, that's pretty humbling, isn't it? When everyone comes streaming past and you know you've upset them all by overtaking them.
We've all been there, haven't we?
There's one more from another mate, Matt Saunders from Autocar. And he says, Ben Samuelson will no doubt be able to confirm this, but I believe the one about the location of the wiring loom being dependent on which day of the week the particular car was built on, because one bloke used to run it over the top of the dash and the other bloke underneath, is actually true. Although Ben says he can't verify that one. He does say that back in the 70s, the wires were all the same colour, which made identifying a fault quite tricky.
Gosh.
Oh dear. It's just TV isn't it?
So here's a question. When we posted that story, I put, you know, those little Twitter polls you can do. And I put out a poll which basically said, do you think TVR will start delivering cars to their customers in 2022? And I had four choices. One was no problem, probably not, or not a chance. And I'm afraid, I think I had nearly 1,000 responses to that. And over 90% of them were either probably not or not a chance. So there is clearly a huge amount of scepticism about that. And I think it's just simply because I think the car's been around since 2017. So far as we're aware, there is only one car, which is the one car that has been seen. I don't think they're being helped by the whole TVR history of things not quite being as you'd hope or want them to be. If I had to guess, and I'm going to say this only in the hope that, if anybody from TVR sees this, they take this as an opportunity to we will prove you wrong. You know, sod you, I'll show you. I think it probably won't happen in 2022. And the real concern is that they really are in danger of being overtaken by time. The market is evolving so fast. People's priorities. And it may be, therefore, that they will actually appeal to the diehards, the guys who, the never say die mob, who just think, well, I'll go and have a TVR because, sod everybody, and I'm not going to change the way that I want to drive my cars just because everybody else is going over to electric this and electric and hybrid that.
Yeah.
So maybe that there's an opportunity there, but I think it's dwindling. And, if they don't, next year's, 2022, it's 5 years after they first showed the car. I really, really hope that they do. Don't get me wrong. I really, really hope that they do. But sitting here right now, looking at it, I would say on balance, I would say it's less likely than more, which is a shame.
If it does come to market, will it be the only V8 normally aspirated manual sports car you can buy?
Oh, it almost already is, isn't it? I mean, you can buy...
You can get a Mustang.
You can get a Mustang. You can get a Corvette. Does that count?
I think so. Will that have a manual? No, I think they're all...
No, it's not. It's BBK Any now, isn't it? Yes, no, you're absolutely right. I'm just trying to think what else there is. Yeah, that might be it.
Maybe some niche stuff. Morgans, have they all gone to automatic gearboxes now? Or can you still get manuals?
Yeah, and they're all turbocharged as well now.
Yeah, oh, yeah, of course. So, well, maybe they're at TVR, they're being very smart and just sitting on it for a few years, allowing all this pent up energy and, desire for a proper old school sports car. Yeah. And
I really, really hope I'm wrong. I've actually had some great times in TVRs, and you always feel good about being in them. You're always doing something fun, aren't you? You know, you're not going to go and commute in the rain in a TVR. You're always going to be out on some fun journey, and I've had some really, really good times in them. So for the avoidance of doubt, I really, really hope it succeeds.
Yeah, I loved TVR and TVRs as a kid. When I was 13, 14, 15, I was absolutely obsessed with them. And I thought they were the most amazing looking things, most amazing sounding things. Yeah. And the interiors, there was a spell, sort of late 90s, perhaps through to the noughties, where the cabins were like spaceships, the most amazing, the architectural forms of those cabins. It was incredible. And I just, do you remember they had the flip paint for a while? They were just to a young adolescent car fanatic. Some of those TVRs were utterly mind blowing. So I get the cynicism around TVR's revival, whether or not it'll happen at all. I think a lot of that skepticism is valid, but there's that teenage kid in me who's just really desperate for it all to happen because I want to have a go in the new Griffith and for it to be brilliant.
Oh, no, I agree. But do you think it'll happen?
I think it's less likely. I think it's unlikely rather than likely to happen, which is a pity, but I don't know. I'd love to be proven wrong, like you say.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. All right, well, let's wrap that one up there. Thank you for watching. I'm still impressed that anyone sits through 50 minutes of this, staring at our faces. I'll tell you what, this time, I'll try and drop some images and perhaps bits of footage throughout that's relevant to what we're talking about, because that'll just spare you having to look at our mugs for a few seconds.
Well, you're going to have to do that now, aren't you? Because you've said it. So if people have got this far and they suddenly realise they haven't seen any images at all, they'll know you failed, so you're going to have to do it now.
Well, I might edit it out if I don't have the time to find all those images. But anyway, thank you for watching and thank you for listening as well. I hope you, if you prefer to listen to an audio podcast, I hope you don't feel as though we're sacrificing that for this new YouTube thing that we're trying to do. But anyway, thank you for listening. Give us some feedback. Leave a review and a rating wherever you get your podcast. That it basically helps surface the podcast and helps other people find it. So it really does make a difference. And remember to head over to Drive Nation on Instagram at @DriveNation_, and follow us there. Andrew, thank you for your time, and we'll do this again next week.
Good to see you. We'll look forward to it. All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.